Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Wednesday, 8 p.m., and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host, and I'm proud to be part of the coolest team on the radio. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and I celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys and then return us safely home. The stories we share on this show entertain us with humor, irony, surprising plot twists, unexpected endings, interesting characters, interesting descriptions of sometimes exotic places. But these stories don't just entertain. They also provide insight and wisdom and courage and strength. They help us understand who we are and what we believe and what values we hold dear. They shine a light on our dark places, and they guide us through tough times. My guest tonight is an expert on stories in general, and Jewish stories in particular. He's the author of over 30 books with such titles as The Torah, Portion by Portion, A Child's Bible, The Essential Jewish Stories, and one I've particularly enjoyed, a book of humorous stories called The Wise Folk of Chelm. He's also written several books on the Holocaust and also several books on religious education, some for children, some for adults. He's even written a book called 1001 Chickens. I love that title. I just had to get that in, Seymour. Rabbi Seymour Rosell, thank you for making the trek all the way from Dallas. And welcome back to So What's Your Story.
It's always exciting to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Well, we're delighted you're here. Now, in preparing for tonight's show, I read a line in a preface that Hank wrote to one of your books where he said that Jewish stories were not so much about learning as about transformation.
And I think he's absolutely right. In fact, they give us an opportunity to change ourselves from within. And the more that we think about the story that we heard, the more chance there is for change over the long haul.
Well, your first story certainly provides an opportunity for transformation, both of a community and of us as individuals, because it's about prejudice. And that seems rather apropos in light of the recent tragedy that occurred in Pittsburgh and other examples of prejudice and anti-Semitism that we've experienced lately. And it's also just a story about how folk tales meander over time. And you've done a lot of research on this story, and I'd like you to share it with us.
This began actually in a book which was written by the secretary of Benjamin Franklin. He once grew impatient, Franklin, at a dinner party being given by lords and ladies in France. And there were some prejudicial remarks aimed directly at the Jewish people, so he called for a Bible. And opening the Bible, he read the story, which I'm going to tell you in a moment, called Abraham and the Old Man. He said that it was found in Genesis chapter 67. And in this way, he delivered a rebuff regarding prejudice in general and anti-Semitism in particular. So when his secretary couldn't remember anything that what Franklin had read, or anything like what Franklin had read, he went back to Genesis and discovered there were only 50 chapters in it. And the story of Abraham the Old Man is nowhere in the Bible. So Franklin had carried off a really masterful hoax in French, doing it in Paris, and managing to sound authentic. So before we go any further, let me tell you the thing that Franklin was talking. So Abraham used to greet every traveler, whether friend or stranger, with open arms. He would welcome them into his tent. He kept his tent on the crossroads so that whether you were coming from the north or the south or the east or the west, you had to pass his tent. And he would welcome the stranger and bring the stranger in and wash the stranger's feet, as nomads always do. And then he would offer the stranger something to eat. And after the meal was over, he would say to the stranger, now I want you to bless the one God. And in this way, his hospitality would lead toward the one God. So this night, he brought in a stranger who was an old man. And he did all of the usual things. He washed the old man's feet, and he offered the old man food. And at the end, he said to the old man, "I hope that you're going to bless the one God with me." And the old man replied, "Oh, no, I only worship fire. Or else, if I can't find fire, I just thank the God of flame and ash. Moreover," the old man said, "when I'm forced to build my own fire, I thank the God of my fingers." This aggrieved Abraham. And he was so upset that he drove the stranger right out of his house. And as soon as he did that, there was a clap of thunder, and God's voice came down and said, "Abraham, what are you doing?" He said, "For 200 years I've been clothing and feeding this man. Even though he denied me, I've been taking care of him, and you can't take care of him for one night?" And Abraham ran out after the old man and brought him back to the tent and took care of him for one night.
So where did you hear this story?
So the first time that I heard the story, actually it was told to me as a Jewish story, mm-hmm. but it was very suspicious. suspicious for two reasons. First of all,
you're peddling suspicious Jewish stories.
Exactly.
Here.
This is a suspicious Jewish story. And first of all, it was suspicious because the old man talks about fire, the mm-hmm. God of fire. Mm-hmm. And Jewish stories don't talk about the God of fire. Also, that was suspicious for another reason, which is most Jewish stories do not make fun of Abraham.
Okay.
In fact, they don't have much of a sense of humor when it comes to making fun of the great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob. So when I began telling this story, I decided I better go find out where it really came from. And it looked to me like had other places, background in other places. I went down to the Jewish section of the New York Public Library, and we began to do research in what was called, this is an arcane thing called the card catalog, for those of you who've never seen. This was very large. In the New York Public Library, it was a whole room. And it turns out that there were some scholarly articles. And one of the scholarly articles pointed out that Benjamin Franklin had written this story around 1755 in classical English to match the King James Version, and had it printed on a small sheet of paper that he folded in half and kept inside his Bible. And whenever there was a talk of prejudice or anti-Semitism at his table or anywhere in his presence, he would call for the Bible, and sometimes he said, "I'll read you my chapter," and he called it chapter 25 or 27 or 26 and sometimes 51. But in any case, he read it whenever he wanted to quash prejudice.
And it was written in the King James vernacular,
exactly.
So it sounded...
16 verses of the King James. It's beautiful. Uh-huh. It really is beautiful. Now, scholars wrote several articles on where Franklin found the story.
Uh-huh.
Most of them agree that the earliest known version was found in a Latin translation of a Hebrew historian's work. But where did the historian get it from? He didn't get it from a Hebrew source. He got it from a 13th century Persian poet, and that explains it all. That explains the reference to fire and ash, because the Persians were Zoroastrians and worshipped fire, and that explains the humor, because the Persians were the ones who gave rise to the Sufis, who were wonderful and taught religion through humor. There's one more strange thing that happened with this story. In 1844, after Franklin, a very classically trained rabbi and historian whose name was Nachman Krachmal wrote the 16 verses into classical Hebrew that sound like it's from the classical Bible. So now, finally, after all those years, Benjamin Franklin's story came home to classical Hebrew and became a classical Hebrew story.
Through the miracle of retrofitting.
That's it.
So talk about using stories being used to rebuff and to criticize as a tool of social change or social criticism.
We often use stories to say something indirectly that we wouldn't want to say directly. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's basically what's going on here. Franklin didn't want to just say, you're fools if you think that you should be prejudiced. He wanted people to think about mm-hmm. what it was that they were doing when they were making prejudiced remarks. Mm-hmm. He wanted to say, you know, look, God has put up with these people for 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. And you can't put up with them for one night. You can't put up with them for one lifetime. And that, I think, is something that any prejudiced person could say, wait a minute, maybe that is true. God right. has put up with these people for 2,000 years.
Right. So you've presented stories as a means of sort of indirectly addressing a social issue.
Right.
And as we all know, a very tragic series of murders occurred in Pittsburgh
yeah.
Recently in the Tree of Life Synagogue. So where does this story fit in that conversation?
So the point is that for about 2,000 years now, Jews have been like the miner's canary for the world.
Mm-hmm.
They are the signal. If you see them being hurt,
right.
If you see them being destroyed, you know there's something viscerally wrong
right.
with the way things are going in the world. And we can see the response to that was amazing.
Yeah.
People came out from every church. They came to synagogues for Friday night services to sit with the Jews. They came from mosques. They
right.
came from people who had no religious background at all came and sat with Jews on Friday night a couple of weeks ago. It was beautiful. Think of us yeah. as the miner's canary, and that's a good way of
that's
fishing.
A great way to look at it. I, as a Gentile, I'm also thinking how much I appreciate Ben Franklin's. It's so tempting just to sort of let those comments go,
right?
And he decided to challenge it, but in a through story,
right? Yeah, obliquely,
yeah.
The best way of getting to truth.
Right.
Is obliquely.
Yeah. Very
In
nice.
Fact, there we have a story about that, right? Which we're about to introduce, right?
But first, I need to do a station reset.
Go right ahead.
If you're just joining us, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org. I'm here with Rabbi Seymour Rozell. Seymour, there's another thing I like about your first story, and I just wanted to get that in, and we'll talk about it later, that it's a story within a story.
Right.
It's almost a story within a story within a story because it just keeps going. It keeps reinventing itself. So your next story, which is called The Perfect Story, is also kind of a story within a story. It combines tales of wisdom. What should we listen for in that story?
What we should look for in this particular story is the humor of little people teaching big people. Or shall we say, simple folk have a lot to teach even the most wise.
Great.
Okay. So there was once a storyteller that I knew. What a storyteller. I mean, really, we're talking. Whenever she spoke, speech became eloquent and ordinary days turned absolutely miraculous. She was entertaining and amusing. She was enlightening, pleasing, prodding, stirring. She never failed. Most amazing of all was that no matter what story she told, it always seemed like the perfect story for that moment. So one day I asked her, what's the secret? How do you do that? And since she's my friend and since she knew that I also tell a story here and there, she said to me, I'll tell you, to know how it's done, I have to tell you a story. this is the story that she told me. A king once sent his son to an academy far away to learn the arts of nobility. And one of these, the king's sons was excelling, and that was in archery. In only 5 years, the master archer taught that boy all he knew, the secrets of how to feather the arrow, how to bend the bow, how to aim, how to judge the wind and distance, the stance and balance you need, and totally unerring release. Mm-hmm. And the prince then, at the end of 5 years, started home. And as he was going home, he stopped to rest his horse and to eat and to sleep at a local inn. And after a satisfying meal, took a brisk walk and was absolutely astounded when he came to a barn. He couldn't believe his eyes. He looked at it. There, on the side of the barn, there were targets painted. And in the very center of each and every target, there was a single arrow that had been driven straight and true to the center. Whoever that archer had been, he had hit dead center without sending as much as one arrow astray. The prince was totally astonished. Who among the people of this small town could possibly be such an expert marksman? And if such one was about, wasn't he the master of all masters of archery? Now the prince stopped every villager and said, "What is going on? Where is this master archer?" But no one in town knew of any archer at all. So at last, in desperation, he sat down, staring at the barn, and stared at the targets. When a boy came along, and the prince stopped him and said, "Do you know who's been taking practice here on the side of the barn?" The boy said, "I have." "You," the prince said, because he saw nothing in front of him except a common ruffian. It sent his royal blood afire to think that this little skipjack could be a great archer. But the prince so loved his art that if there was something left to learn, he was determined to learn it. "Show me," he said to the boy. And the boy said, "Sure, come on along." And together they stood opposite the barn, and from a fair distance the boy took aim and loosed an arrow from his bow, and it sailed through the air and struck with a thud at the spot away from any of the other targets. Prince was now totally confused. Nor did his confusion abate when the boy ran into the barn, emerging a moment later with a brush and a can of paint. But all became clear when the boy painted a solid circle around that arrow he had just shot, and following that, painted two more circles around the dot to make a target. "And that's how it does. That's how it's done," said the boy. "First I shoot at the wall, and then I draw the target." "And now you know, my friend," said my storyteller friend, "why I always have the right story for each and every occasion."
Speaking of retrofitting stories, you can retrofit your targets as well.
Yes, exactly.
So what is it that the teller wants us to learn from that story?
That you have to design the stories, the way you tell the stories, to make the point that you want to make. Yeah. The target is up to you. Mm-hmm. Shooting straight is a good idea. That's a good idea. But once you've shot straight, if you make the target fit, if you make the story fit, then the audience thinks that you have done something totally masterful,
right?
Something totally miraculous. And in fact, you have.
You have. You've hit the mark.
That's right. You have. You've created the target.
Now, talk about the technique. That's another example of a story within a story. Talk
right.
about that technique.
So this is a very common technique, and I think that it's one which is very popular, actually. Mm-hmm. We come across them over and over and over again. The reason is that each story within the story elucidates and makes the point more clearly. Mm-hmm. And then the external story becomes clear like a surprise at mm-hmm. the other end. So it's a very nice technique for telling stories. I like it.
Yeah. The thing that strikes me is, I don't know if this is, you've heard of this thing called the trans-theoretical model of change. It's also known as the stages of change. That when we change our mind about something, it doesn't just go from off to on. There's a series of processes where we begin to get open to something different, and we gradually open ourselves to a new idea, and then eventually we open ourselves to a new behavior. So to me, the story within a story, it gives the listener a little more time to change.
Right, right.
To mull this over.
There's one more thing, I think, which you just sparked for me. Mm-hmm. I remember a time talking about memory and hearing somebody say that it is never possible to go back into your memory except with a question.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you only access your memory if you have some reason to do that.
Right.
So you access your memory with a question. He said, but also it's never possible to access your memory without changing it.
Oh, wow.
So the target is always moving.
Yeah.
You may constantly think that you have gone after the same memory, but you never see the same memory twice. Mm-hmm. It's like trying to cross the same river twice.
Yeah. This story, I enjoyed reading it in one of your books, book about stories from the Jewish tradition. And when I read it, I had this epiphany. When I was young, there was a man that I knew who was, I thought, the best storyteller I'd ever heard.
Right.
And he could give a presentation on any subject, and he would have the perfect story. And I only realized later in life, he started with good stories.
Right.
And then made sure that story fit the topic.
Exactly.
He didn't just happen to have a story on, you know, the point. He learned how to massage the stories.
Right.
He was masterful.
That is a great art.
Yeah.
That is a great art.
Well, the rabbi in Fiddler on the Roof claimed, or in an exasperated tone, I believe, it's been a while, there is a prayer for everything. It seems to be true with Jewish stories, too. So finding the right story for the occasion, how important is that for being a spiritual storyteller?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't know if I'm a spiritual storyteller. Mm-hmm. I try to stay calm and collected while I tell a story, not get too spiritual, because otherwise I'll be too far away to tell the story. But hopefully people are inspired, and that's what you're talking about. I think being inspired by a story is a wonderful thing. If I can bring a story to life so that people can imagine it with their minds, then I think it sparks memories for them, and it sparks imagination for them also. So that makes a perfect story. And Jewish stories do that in a lot of ways.
Tell us your next story, The Old Man and the Snake.
Well, this is a story which tells a message, but I'm still confused after all these years as to what that exact message is. And so we can talk about that right afterward. But this is one of the most complicated stories that I do know. And it is a story which is extremely extremely well represented in Jewish folklore.
Okay.
That is to say, it was being told in Northern Europe at the same time it was being told in Morocco and Spain. It was being told all over the world. In slightly different versions, but always the same exact story. Mm-hmm. It begins with an old man who's walking down the road on a cold day, and he sees a snake dying at the side of the road. And he takes pity on the snake. So he picks it up, and he tries to warm it with his body. And as he's holding it close to his body to warm it, the snake begins to squirm a little bit and feel a little bit better. And the man thought, well, maybe this is a good time to put the snake down. But suddenly the snake was coiling itself around the old man and beginning to crush him. And the old man cried out, "What? Are you going to kill me? I just saved your life. Haven't you got any gratitude?" And the snake hissed out a laugh and said, "I thank you for saving my life, but it turns out now I'm hungry." And it's commanded in the Torah, which is the five books of Moses, that the snake is supposed to be the eternal enemy of human beings. I'm just doing what God commanded. And as soon as I finish crushing you, I'm going to have you for a meal, and then I'll be even more grateful that you saved my life. And the old man started to plead for his life, crying out, "Oh, I demand that we take this case to a judge. Really, we have to go to a judge." And the snake hissed a bit and said, "What kind of judge?" The old man said, "Well, look, we'll find one. Just keep walking a little bit." So sure enough, as they walked, they came upon an ox out in the field. And the man called to the ox, saying, "Tell this snake not to kill me. I just saved its life." And the ox said, "It's a cruel world, this place. All day long I have to plow, and all day long the farmer beats me with his stick. And you're kind enough to save the snake's life, but I don't really care if the snake kills you or kisses you. And with that, the ox went back to plowing. The snake coiled itself more tightly around the man, and the man said, that was no judgment. He didn't judge. We have to find a judge. And just at that moment, there came by a lion. And the snake called to him and said, come on and judge a case of law. This old man saved my life, but the Torah says I'm supposed to kill him because he's a human being. What do you think I should do? The lion snarled and said, that old man is a fool. Of what use are manners in the world of tooth and claw? Whoever is stronger should prevail. That's the way of the world. And the lion turned and walked away. Well, said the snake, it seems there's no one to take your side. But the old man said the lion's words might be true, but he didn't really judge the case. We have to really find a judge. The snake hissed and said, I'm getting hungry. Whatever the next judge says, that's final. But the snake was thinking, I'm right. There's nobody who's going to judge this old man to be right. So they came upon a young fellow, and they watched as he was dropping stones into a well. And as he dropped the stones, the water in the well got a little higher and a little higher until he was able to reach in and pick up the walking stick that was floating on top of the water, which he had dropped into the water by accident. Now, said the old man to the snake, this is a wise young man. Let him be the last judge. The snake hissed and said, okay, so be it. And the young man listened as the snake and the old man told their story. He said, you ask me to render judgment, so you have to do as I say. He turned to the snake and he said, since you quote the Torah, you must know that the Torah says if two people are being judged, they have to stand equal in the sight of the law. So you have to climb down from the old man and stand next to him. The snake eyed the young man suspiciously. Slowly he unwound from the old man and stood up beside him, but he coiled the bottom half of his body so that he could spring up on that old man in an instant. Now, said the young man to the snake, why do you want to kill this man who saved your life? It's written in the Torah, said the snake, that the snake has to bite the heel of the human being. God commanded me to kill him. Yes, the young man said, that's true. But it's also written in the Torah that the human shall bruise the head of the snake. And suddenly the young man handed his walking stick to the old man, who raised it up and brought it down on the snake's head, killing the snake. And that, said the young man, is what you were commanded to do from the very beginning. Only later the old man learned that this wise young judge was none other than Solomon, the teenage son of King David of Jerusalem.
That's not exactly a touchy-feely story.
Not exactly.
I sense it's dealing with some pretty serious issues. What do you think this story's about?
So it's about hatred, and it's about kindness, and it's about all of those things put together. If you find someone on the side of the road who is dying, your instinct would be to go over and help them. This can be good in the sense that if it's a good person, then it's a good thing that you did. Mm-hmm. But what if the person you're helping turns out to be an evil person? Mm-hmm. In this case, so evil that it was like a snake. Mm-hmm. And it immediately coiled itself around and said, now I'm hungry.
Yeah.
So if you think back to instances such as the civil rights movement, for example, where Jewish people tried to reach out and help black people in the 50s and the 60s,
freedom rides,
and through helping to found the NAACP and helping to fund a lot of work in the South, and actually going down and doing work in the South with blacks together. It was a time when Jews and blacks worked together very closely. Mm-hmm. But as the time passed, the blacks began to feel like they were being used or disadvantaged. and that the that they said, you know, well, you guys are also the landlords. You guys are also the you're also rich, and you're not like us, and we need to stand on our own 2 feet. We can't have. And then it got worse and worse until finally there was no connection at all between Jews and blacks, except for negative connections. Mm-hmm. And then you come up with someone like this Louis Farrakhan guy. I can mention the name on radio, I hope. Okay. So the fact is that it's a dangerous world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is a dangerous world. And if you try to do kind for people, sometimes the people you're trying to do kind for can be very ungrateful.
Mm-hmm.
They can be very difficult. But on the other hand, don't you want to do kind for people?
Right.
In my humble estimation, being Jewish is like a 3,000-year experiment in kindness. That's what it is. So I think, in a sense, you have to do the reaching out.
Mm-hmm.
In one sense, you have to be the old man.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be vulnerable.
Right.
And in another sense, you have to be like Solomon. You have to be the judge and say, I can't do this.
Right.
I just can't do this. In the first place, I shouldn't have done it.
You kind of have to be kind and gentle and caring and all that. On the other hand, you have to be a little bit wise and suspicious and figure out how to balance that.
Right. And yeah. It's like the politicians in Washington. Is it safe to reach across the aisle?
Right. Right.
I think there are applications in everyday life.
I think of the one that just happened a couple of years ago. Remember the Republican baseball team was practicing baseball, and
sure.
That horrible shooting took place.
Right.
But one of the heroes was a police officer who saved the life, literally, of one of the congressmen.
Right.
And he was from Louisiana. We don't need to mention his name. And yet, as soon as he got out of the hospital, there was a report that he was speaking at a sort of to a group that was anti-gay. And I thought that shows a little bit of a lack of appreciation.
Right.
For this. The police officer had been an openly lesbian woman. And I thought, well, she did the right thing. But, you know, she didn't get appreciated for it in the way she probably would have liked.
It's a complicated story. I'm working on it.
I
hope we can figure it out, but it takes a long time, and it's a lot of work.
Well, it's a 3,000-year process so far, as you said.
It definitely is.
Well, I'm going to give you a little chance to catch your breath, Seymour, and meanwhile, I'm going to check in with Tatiana.
Well, first of all, we want to thank, once again, everyone who's donated at the October Fund Drive. We're always thanking you on air, but two of you donated after last week's show, so we're going to thank you now. Greg and Deep T, thank you so much for your generous donations.
And by the way, Greg and Deep T have both been guests, storytelling guests on this show, and we appreciate your support.
And speaking of excellent storytelling, if you'd like to hone your storytelling skills, check out our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. They meet for a story swap for the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. located at Temple Emanuel, which is at 1500 Sunset Boulevard. And next Saturday, November 17th, the Guild is sponsoring its event, Telebration Celebration, in honor of the International Day of Storytelling. The storytelling party will be held at the Black Lab Restaurant at Montrose Boulevard from 6 to 9 p.m. And to learn about this and other storytelling events, visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. And while you're there, you can listen to all of our past So What's Your Story programs. In fact, you'll find every show since 2008. That's a lot of shows. Just click on the radio program tab.
And a reminder that next week is Moth Week. Tuesday night, 7:30 p.m., Warehouse Live. The theme will be beginnings. You'll hear stories about new jobs, new puppies, new lovers, or anything else that you'd like to share if you'd like to be a storyteller. But these are true stories from real people. And speaking of good stories and great shows, what have we got cooking for next week?
Oh, la la, on the new lovers. So Mary will be hosting, and her guests will be Rich Johnson, Nadia Hakim, Mark Shodden, and about life just outside the lines. Always serving up unique top spins on personal themes on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT 90.1 FM. And if you don't own a radio, that's no problem, because you can listen to a stream live on kpft.org and Facebook. And we're also on YouTube as well. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave.
Thank you, Tatiana. Now back to more stories in the second half of our show. My guest is Rabbi Seymour Roselle. And if you're a regular listener, you'll know that usually we have at least two storytelling guests on this show, but this time we're making a pretty special exception. Seymour has traveled here all the way from Dallas. I don't mind saying that, although I prefer Houston. And he's a great storyteller. So we're going to get as many stories out of him tonight as we can. So, Seymour, I understand your next story is about the meaning of storytelling itself.
That's true. So this takes us back to a very early time, probably around the 2nd or 3rd century of the modern era. And the question that was in front of the group was, how did Solomon's wisdom enhance God's glory? And they came up with the following conclusions. They said Solomon made handles for the Torah. They made handles for the Bible. And what were those handles? They were parables. Mm-hmm. Rabbi Nachman began with his parable, saying, imagine you had a maze-like palace with many halls and many doors. Whoever entered the palace was lost in an instant and could never find the way out again. Along came a clever fellow who tied a coil of rope to the entrance so that whoever entered could take the loose end of the rope and feel free to explore the whole palace, knowing that in the end it would only be necessary to follow the rope right back to the entrance. Solomon was that clever fellow. Until he arose, no one was able to find their way through the words of the Bible. But Solomon attached the parable at the entrance to the Bible, and soon everyone began to comprehend all of God's words. Again, Rabbi Nachman said, I know another parable. Imagine a thicket of reeds, which no one could penetrate, till one clever man came along and took a scythe, and he cut down some of the reeds, making a path. Then everyone began to enter through that path that had been cut. Solomon was that clever man. By means of parables, Solomon cut a path through this Bible that many could follow. Then Rabbi Yossi took up a parable, and he said, imagine a huge basket full of fruit, but it didn't have any handle, so it couldn't be lifted. And along came a clever man and attached handles to it. From then on, the basket could be carried by the handles. Solomon was that clever man. Before Solomon applied parables to the Bible, no one could properly understand it. But by means of the parables, the words of the Bible could be lifted and carried, so even the simplest person could comprehend the Bible. Then Rabbi Shila took up a parable, saying, imagine a jug filled to the brim with hot water, but there was no handle by which to carry it. Along came a clever man and attached a handle to the jug. Solomon was that clever man, and after he applied the parable, the white-hot words of the Bible could be taken from one end of the earth all the way to the other. Then Rabbi Hanina took up his parable, saying, imagine a deep well that was full of cold and sweet and refreshing water, but no one could drink from the well. Along came a clever man who tied rope to rope and cord to cord until the water could be drawn pail by pail from the well. Solomon was that clever man. He tied parable to parable and example to example until the inmost words of the Bible came to the surface where everyone could drink them in and gain all that health and healing. All of our sages together taught us the parable is very deceptive. Those who take it lightly are woefully mistaken, because by means of the parable, everyone can master the teachings of the Bible. If a king loses a gem from his crown at night, it doesn't require an army to find it. Only a wick for his oil lamp. A wick. Seems like such a petty thing, but don't take it lightly. The parable is a wick for finding concealed gems. By means of the parable, the true meanings of the Bible can always be revealed.
Wow. There's so many rich metaphors there. I love it.
One right after another.
But I got to say, you're a rabbi, right? And you're talking about parables. I thought parables, that was a Jesus thing.
Right, exactly. So people do think they associate parables with Jesus because Jesus was talking in parables and teaching, as we said a minute ago, obliquely, instead of coming at it directly. And that was one of the specialties, and we see it over and over again in the New Testament. But the New Testament is a very Jewish book.
Yeah.
Jesus was always a Jew, didn't have a chance to convert, so he remained a Jew to the end of his life. And so he was actually using a technique which these rabbis were talking about together. It was exactly the same technique, a parable, to teach. And it was a very popular technique at that time. It was extremely popular. And it continues to be popular to the present day. But think about how popular it really is, okay? We're talking now about the time of Jesus, which was like the first century, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But in the time, by the 7th century before Jesus, okay, 7th century, there was a guy whose name was Aesop. We've heard of him, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, every one of his things is a parable.
So right.
All of his teachings are fables, but we know them to be parables. And in fact, they're so much parables that the signature for an Aesop story is that it ends with a teaching.
Right.
It ends with a proverb, often underlined in the texts.
Right.
Which is so interesting, and that is true. But before Jesus. And before Aesop, and before the rabbis came along, the Bible was already doing it thousands of years before that, about 1,000 years before that, actually. Mm-hmm. And the Bible was doing it in forms which we recognize. You think about one of the stylistic markings of a parable very often is that there's a talking animal.
Right, right,
right.
Right.
You think about
and same with Aesop. Or
right,
same
exactly.
With the story same you just
with,
story
in Aesop, there are even some talking plants.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the story that I just told, the old man and the snake is a student of the Bible. Nobody, you know, nobody notices that, but it's true.
Right.
And the fact is that in the Bible itself, there is a snake who talks.
Uh-huh.
That's the Garden of Eden snake.
Right.
The most beautiful voice in the garden, obviously.
Yeah.
And also the most deceitful.
Right.
So the Garden of Eden snake is a parable. That
right.
whole Garden of Eden story is a parable. So is the Tower of Babel.
Right.
A parable. And so is the story of Noah and the flood. When you think about it, nobody could build a single boat that would inhabit all of the animals of the world, but that is a parable for right. how we save life, how we manage to save life by being faithful to God. And that's a wonderful parable, no matter what the flood is. And here in Houston, we've had a few.
No matter biblical what proportions.
Yeah, biblical proportions, right. No matter what the flood is, we can save ourselves through our faith, which is wonderful, nice parable. There's talking donkeys in the Bible. There's all kinds of parables. And, of course, Solomon. And his wisdom at the same time. So this story about Solomon and how he created parables to understand the Bible is very interesting because it turns upon itself.
Right.
In actuality, the Bible already created parables to help you understand the Bible.
Right. The way I gather it, the ancient world was sort of a world that was more about talking than reading.
Yes.
And so they just swam in a world of stories,
yes.
parables.
Yes, although I have to tell you that we do believe that there was a lot of literacy.
Yeah.
A lot of literacy, okay. even among women at that time. And there are some very interesting stories that we can come back and tell another time.
Oh, we would love that. We would love that. Because that's not something
it's
many
off
of us
the
know
beaten
about.
Path, yeah. right, exactly. Yeah.
This is Warren Hollum, and I'm here with my guest, Seymour Rozell, on 90.1 FM and www.kpft.org. Now, Hank is also here tonight. I mentioned earlier that he wrote the preface to one of Seymour's books, and I'd like to bring him in on the conversation now. I have a couple of questions I want to bounce off of Hank and Seymour together. And the questions are, this is your exam.
Uh-huh.
What is distinctive about Jewish folklore, and what types of questions do Jewish stories try to answer?
Well, hi. I just love this show, and you know, Seymour knows how much I love him, and I'm pretty much mesmerized by all of these stories. And frankly, I'm not so sure that I have anything to add except that one of my favorite quotations is an old Yiddish proverb which reads, "What's truer than truth? The story." And I think that in many ways that is a sort of a culminating remark about so many things that Seymour is saying tonight. You know, when I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, we had a book called Jewish Folklore, and my grandmother kept it in the closet. You know, I don't know why. It was some small closet. And whenever I asked her a question, it could be anything from, you know, who's God, to why is the grass green, to why are we having chicken again for the sixth consecutive night. Regardless of the question, her answer would be, go read the book. And I would say, but Grammy, it's only one question. She said, read the book. That's what she said to me. Go read the book. So she would force me to read all of these incredibly entertaining parables, albeit, but I was 12 years old, 11 years old, whatever. And I learned so much in terms of solving problems by reading so many of these tales. You know, one of my favorite stories of recent years, and Seymour knows this one better than anyone, and that's the one by I.L. Peretz, Even Higher, is a story that I frequently tell my students in class because it's a story that's so adaptable. And here's why adaptability is so important. My grandmother taught me that when she told me to read all of these stories. Adapt them to your own problem resolution. And, you know, in Judaism, we believe that the only way to really defend the rights of one person is to defend the rights of all others, if that makes sense. And it's about adaptability. It's about transference. So when, for example, I listen to stories like Even Higher, it's originally about a Litvak, a small boy in Lithuania who follows a rabbi into the wilderness. But it could be a small Chinese boy. It could be a Cuban child. It could be an African-American child in Detroit. It doesn't make any difference. You don't change the integrity of the story in order to teach the story, if that makes sense. Seymour, does that make sense to you? See what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what I think is so incredibly unique about Jewish folklore. It is its transformation, its adaptability, it's the ease with which we can maintain the integrity of the story and yet change the characters and the setting and the context and the plot, and it still formulates into the same parable with which it was originated.
The nice thing about it is that you can tell a story about Abraham, or you can tell a story about Moses, or you can tell a story about anyone in the Bible, and the Bible remains the same. So someone else can come along and tell another story based on the same thing you told the story about and totally different from your story. And that's how the Jewish people have entertained themselves through the ages. And it's also how the Jewish people teach. They teach through stories.
Is this something that happens over centuries that's sort of parallel to what happens just when you sit around a table drinking a beer with your friends and somebody tells a story about their dog and then somebody else says, well, I've got one about my dog, and then the stories kind of build on each other?
Yes. Yes,
exactly. All began in my home with my grandmother. She started it all. Yeah, she started it all. I always tell the story about I asked my grandmother one night what's for dinner, and she tells me the story about the little boy at the carnival, and I sat there for 20 minutes trying to figure out what dinner had to do with the little boy at the carnival, and after a half hour, I realized I should never ask her what's for dinner again. I think she started it all.
There was a famous rabbi who took his students to see a circus. And the students were totally amazed by the fellow on the high wire who was walking across from one side to the other. And they looked at the rabbi and they said, why is that man doing that? Isn't he risking his life at every step? And the rabbi said, oh, it doesn't matter. the fact is, he may be risking his life at every step, but he's not thinking about that at all. He's thinking about every step. And if he doesn't think about every step, he won't make it to the other end of the wire. We have to think about every step we take. That's the story.
Wow. Well, Seymour, in just a minute, I'm going to ask you to tell your last story. We're going to go out on that. But I want to give you a chance to our listeners would like to know where they can get your books.
Ah, well, Amazon.com is a wonderful gimmick. BarnesandNoble.com is also. And both of them carry all of my books.
And tell them about your website.
And I have a website at rossell.net, www.rossell.net. And you can get to it by just looking up Seymour Rossell on Google or any other search engine. You can have a search engine of your choice. And don't worry, there's all kinds of stuff there to explore. Some people say they can get lost in it.
Yes, I've done that. And they can order your... I ordered your books through Amazon. I've got four of them now.
Wow.
So,
That's good.
So I want to give you a chance to close with a story that is about the intersection of life and wisdom. And I'll have to say it's also an inspirational story. It's something really nice to go out on. And I think it holds within it the key, or at least one of the keys. Pardon me for saying this, being so presumptuous, but it holds one of the keys to the meaning of life.
Okay. So we have a story called Is It Alive or Is It Dead? And the very interesting thing about this story is that it was told for the first time that I heard it. It was told around a campfire by a very special fellow whose name was Isaac Bashevis Singer, who's no longer with us, but was a great, great Yiddish storyteller. And I was only 16 when I first heard this story, and he told it, and it stuck with me.
You heard him tell it?
That's right, and it stuck with me to this very day. In a small town, a rabbi lived who was well known for his wisdom, and Jews from miles around used to come to study with him. And they studied by challenging him with whatever difficult questions that they had, for the pure joy of listening to his brilliant answers. And the people of the town where he lived took great pride in bragging about their resident sage. But then one little youngster in the town was a real smart aleck. He was very jealous of the rabbi, and he said, "I'm as smart as that old man is. I can certainly pose some question that he can't possibly answer. Of course," he said, "I'll have to think of it first, but when I do, people won't think that old rabbi is so smart." So the youngster set himself the task of devising questions that the rabbi couldn't answer. Every day, the student went to the house of study, and every day he asked the rabbi a question he imagined was too difficult. This one's going to be too difficult. This one the rabbi won't be able to answer. And yet every day, to the bitter disappointment of the young man, the rabbi would answer his question, and all the people gathered around would marvel at the rabbi's wisdom. Finally, that youngster conceived a clever plan. He decided that he could outsmart the rabbi in a special way. He went out and caught a small bird, and he brought the bird to the rabbi. Now, he cupped the bird in the space between his two hands in such a way that the bird couldn't actually be seen. "Rabbi," said the young man, "I have a question that with all of your wisdom, even you can't answer. In my hands, I'm holding a tiny bird. Tell me, is the bird alive or is it dead?" What a strange question. The people gathered closer, the better to hear the rabbi's answer. But how would the rabbi know? And the youngster, he smirked, because he was certain that the rabbi could not answer this one. His plan was very clever. If the rabbi said the bird is dead, then the boy would open his hands, and the bird would fly away, very much alive. But if the rabbi replied, "Well, the bird is alive," then the student would quickly crush the tiny bird with his palms, open his hands, and reveal a dead bird. For a while, that rabbi just sat there lost in thought. His eyes were closed, and one hand played with his beard. And at last he opened his eyes, and he looked at the young man, and he said, "My child, in your hand you are holding a life. Choose very carefully what to do with it." And that, I think, is true for all of us. Every day and in every way, you hold in your hands a life. And the true wisdom, I think, always lies in being careful what you choose to do with it.
And you're going to leave us there without solving the problem. That's wonderful. I think you've given us something to think about. Seymour, you traveled 500 miles, 250 miles each way.
Actually.
To be with us tonight, to share stories and bring us wisdom and courage and a laugh or two as well. And I know I needed those stories, and I think our listeners did as well. Seymour, you also traveled 500 miles to teach us about the role that stories play in preserving the traditions of a culture and in shaping our values and our beliefs. And during this time when prejudice and racism seem to be on the rise, we so need these stories. Seymour, thank you for traveling those 500 miles to be with us, live and in person. And if that's not love, I don't know what love is. Thank you for being on So What's Your Story.
And thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure. I look forward to being with you again sometime.
I can't wait. We'll schedule it before you leave tonight. And one more thing. Thank you for reminding us that folk tales keep traditions alive. And in Jewish culture, what could be more important than tradition? Nothing. Don't you dare move, because the cool new Flash Gordon Parks is up next. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren, along with Seymour and Hank and Tatiana and the rest of the So What's Your Story team. We never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
And who does Mama teach to mend and tend and pick, preparing her to marry whoever
God has. Go tell it on the mountain. Go talk it to the seashore. Whisper it in the breeze. Say it wherever you please. But it's a secret that needs to get out. So tell a friend that you heard it on KPFT. It's a secret that should be shouted out. From the highest overpass to the bends in the bayou, you heard it on KPFT. If it's worth hearing, if it's worth discussing, KPFT gets the word out. So tell a friend to turn on, tune in, and listen to radio for your mind. Call 713-526-5738 to sign up a friend today. Thank you for supporting KPFT Houston, listener-sponsored radio for peace.
Last call.